You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'm just going to start off by introducing our panelists. Dan Lichter is the Ferris Family Professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management and Professor of Sociology at Cornell. He's past president of the PAA and the Rural Sociological Society, and he's served as editor of Demography as well. And he's published widely on the topics that we're going to cover, and so that I don't use up any more of his time, I'm going to stop there, although I could go on.
Thanks, Marianne, and thanks to all of you for coming. In some ways, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act was a major social experiment. And this was especially the case about the family, because here we had government going in and trying to do something about the family. And in fact, when you look at the welfare bill itself, it starts out with the findings from the Congress saying marriage is the foundation of a successful society. And it goes on from there to give me a blank page. There we go. So all four of the goals listed right off the bat have some dimension of the family involved. Kids being cared for in their own home, reducing the level of economic dependence by promoting lots of things, including marriage, reducing the incidence of pregnancies, and encouraging there at the bottom the formation and maintenance of two-parent families. So it's a major part of the bill. And so what I want to do today is talk about what are the consequences of this piece of legislation, what do we know, where do we need to go next. When you look at some of the provisions, I just want to mention a few of these here. All of them are linked in some way or another, and I think Ron was wise this morning to talk about many of the dimensions, the things that we don't always talk about. But I want to just say, even in the case of promoting work among single mothers, you know, you could argue based on the literature that getting mothers into the workforce and making more money provides greater exposure to potential marital partners, makes them more economically attractive as potential partners and so on, and may indirectly then encourage more marriage. Time limits may also create incentives to find another way to stay off welfare, and one of those may be marriage. Or state bonuses, that in the end it was difficult to show that state bonuses to reduce non-marital fertility in the absence of increases in abortion had any effect, and I don't think that program is even in existence anymore. Or caps on welfare receipt among new mothers, the idea that we're going to cut welfare for mothers who are already on welfare and have children. We're not going to give them any additional, and states had the option of doing that. Or restrictions on teen mothers living on their own. That is, we didn't want teenage or young mothers to see pregnancy and childbearing as an opportunity or a way to actually leave the parental home. And lastly, the thing that a lot of us, I think, have been interested in, especially with the Bush administration, was so-called marriage education and the healthy marriage incentive. So what do we know from all these things? Well, in the Healthy Marriage Initiative program, these demonstration grants, there's a number of things that were done, actually, that's provided money. And I'm not going to list them all here, but we're talking about public advertising campaigns for the value of healthy marriages, marriage education skills, marriage relationship skills, and so on. And we can go down through this list. So what have these demonstration projects, these evaluations, actually tell us about their success? Did they work or not? Did we promote marriage? Did we promote more healthy relationships? Did we reduce non-marital fertility? Did we provide a better parental context for both childbearing, I guess, and child rearing? Well, one program, and this is, you know, there's other evaluations as well, but I mean, one place to start is a recent report that was done by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. This evaluation, just to quote here, said the results indicate that about 24 months after implementation of program services, the primary outcomes showed no pattern of significant differences, whether examined overall or separately within each of the three matched community pairs. So people have done these meta-analyses, these analysis of analysis, and basically the bottom line seems to be that these programs have not had very much effect, these evaluations, these interventions. And we could, and I'd be interested in what the panel has to say about this. Does this reflect a lot, not enough money? Does it reflect that these things weren't constructed properly? Have we not done these in the context where they're likely to be the most successful? What are the law? Maybe we haven't waited long enough. So these are all issues, I think. But in so far, most of the analysis that I've seen of these things haven't been terribly successful if measured by demonstrable causal effects using a randomized control trial, for example. So the bottom line is it's not easy to demonstrate larger significant effects. And even when you go to the non-experimental research, to the observational studies where you're using big data sets and so on, it's also difficult there to show that there's been very much effect just by looking at the overall trends. There's a new paper that's coming out next year in the Annual Review of Sociology by my colleague Laura Tack and Kathy Eden. And just to quote from their report, this is not online yet, but they say, despite its effects on work and income, and of course this is the idea that work and income may make women more marriageable, the transformed safety net has had little impact on family formation and stability, at least in the ways that researchers have traditionally measured these things. And I'll come back to that at the end. Welfare reform, EITC expansions, and growing access to in-kind benefits have had little influence, they say, on marriage or on non-marital fertility. So they're not terribly optimistic that these programs have had big effects, at least effects in the non-experimental realm that can that actually show up in the data. Now, I want to plug, I've done a little work on this in the past. There's a new chapter that's coming out in this compendium of chapters that Robert Moffat, who's going to be in the next session, talked about. But he talked about our study that I did in the Journal of Public Policy Analysis and Management a few years ago, where what we did is we did a sort of conventional difference in difference model where we looked at before and after welfare reform after 1996. And what we found was that there was no differences when you compared the targets of welfare reform, say low educated women or women who weren't working, with the marriage patterns among those who were not typically eligible for welfare reform. There were very little differences in terms of basic marriage rates. What was different is that women after, low income women after welfare actually tended to marry men that were less marriageable by conventional standards, that they were less likely to be employed, less likely to make a lot of money. And of course, this goes back into a lot of research about whether marriage is a panacea of sorts and whether women who are incentivized to marry actually stay married or whether they marry a marriageable man who can lift them off welfare and out of poverty. And, you know, the implications from this early non-experimental research is difficult. Again, it's difficult to show big effects. The other place it's a bit hard to show big effects is when you actually just look at the basic trends. And so what I did is I tried to find studies or data sets that compared the pre-welfare reform period, the early 90s, with any period afterwards in the 2000s or beyond on several different dimensions. So I wanted to look just at marriage trends. I wanted to look at cohabitation, which for the majority of young people today has become the first union rather than marriage. It's become the 75% or so of young people today will cohabit before they actually marry. And then talk a little bit about non-marital fertility, and I think Ron this morning mentioned teen pregnancy in particular and childbearing has gone down, and we can talk about whether that's a function of a consequence to the welfare reform bill. And then we can talk about living arrangements, children's living arrangements, and how those have actually changed. Are children living in better circumstances than they were prior to welfare reform? Janet had a quite optimistic view of all these things this morning. I'm probably a little bit pessimistic, at least in this context, about family and marriage and fertility. So let's start with marriage trends. What's happened over the past half century. And here on the bottom axis, is we've just got years from 1950 to the year 2015. And on the left-hand axis, the y-axis, it's just the percentages. And the dots there are data from the decennial census, each decennial census period. And the solid line is data from the current population survey, the March supplement. And when you look at this, it's just a straight downward trend, that top line there of the shares that are married, increasing shares that are never married, not much change overall in patterns of divorce, especially over the last 20 years or so, 25 years since 1990, it's been basically flat. Not very much evidence here that there's been some sort of mark at 1996 or 2000 where we've suddenly seen a slowing of the decline or the retreat from marriage to something where it's pushing back upward. We see also this continuing shift in the timing of marriage. That is, people are getting, men and women both are getting married at much older ages. And this graph, again, is on the same scale here. And you can look at, since 1970 or so, this just basically straight upward shift in the age at marriage. People are getting much married much older. Men almost 30 now. Women have always been about 2 years younger than men. So that hasn't changed very much either. It's hard to see any kind of break there at 1996 or even a five-year period or 10-year period surrounding 1996. This is an interesting chart here because here you're looking at the percentages of women ages 40 to 44. If they're going to get married, they're probably going to get married by this period. They should have been married. Most people, if they marry, will have been married by age 40 to 44. And the interesting thing here, this goes from 1940 to 2014. And you can see this continuing downward tick over time. You can see African Americans, blacks are at the bottom there in terms of the shares that are ever married. They've never been married. We're talking about 40% have never been married, 60% have. But the important thing here, I think, is to put this in relationship to the implementation of the bill again. And you can think back of these 20 to 24, or these 40 to 44-year-olds, 20 years earlier, they were 20 to 24. And so there's no evidence here that black young women or other disadvantaged groups, historically American Indians or Hispanics, have seen an uptick in the shares that will eventually marry. In fact, there's been an increasing retreat from marriage, even if you measure it by the percentages that have never been married. And I think it's also important to look at what's happened here with respect to the populations that are most affected by welfare reform, presumably it be those who have less education as opposed to those who have more education. And this is something that came out by the Pew Institute. And here we're just comparing in 2008 the non-college educated with the college educated. You can see about 60%. It's slightly higher in 2008, slightly higher for the college educated. But look what happened in 1990 before welfare reform. Exactly the opposite, where the less educated were more likely to be married than the college educated. So the declines over time have been most rapid among the groups that we had hoped to target positively regarding marriage, and that's the least educated, those who would be most likely to be on welfare reform or on welfare. Now, a lot of this pattern has to do with cohabitation. And so I'm going to make a pitch at the end that I think we need to spend more time talking about cohabitation. This is just a very simple chart that these data come from the National Survey of Family Growth. And fortuitously, they have data from this survey. It's a repeated cross-sectional design. So we can look at women of a particular age, women of reproductive age, before welfare, 1982, 1995, and then after welfare, 2002, and then this other period, 2006 to 2010. And on the left-hand side there, you see the proportion that are currently in a first marriage. That is, they're in a first marriage, and they're staying in a first marriage. So it doesn't include second marriages or higher-order marriages. And you can see this downward tick here over this study period from 44%, or let's state, with 40% in 1995, pre-welfare reform, to 36% in this last period at the end of 2010. An 8 percentage point decline that's completely matched by the uptick in the shares of people of this age who are now in a cohabiting union. And what's happened is that the demographers know this, age at first union has not changed at all in American society. It's the same. What's changed is whether that first union happens to be a cohabiting union or happens to be a marriage. And most people today are cohabiting first, and their first union experience is tends to be cohabitation. Again, to show you this upward tick and also to show you that this increase has been particularly pronounced among those groups of women that are most likely to be at risk of receiving TANF, this is a chart. Again, the lighter color here is 1995, pre-welfare reform. The later period is 2006 to 2010. And you can see the shares now whose first union was a cohabiting union as opposed to something else. So, for example, among the least educated, that percentage went from 46% to 70%, a very large upward tick. And we see an upward tick across all the educational categories. But in terms of a percentage basis, the uptick has been the largest here with the least educated. And that is those with less than a high school education or a high school, and that's only. So cohabitation has disproportionately affected those at the bottom of the status hierarchy, those most at risk of receiving of TANF. Now, what's really interesting here, and I've done some work on this, is what happens to what's the disposition of these cohabiting unions? What happens to them? Do they last? Do they segue into marriage? Maybe it's not so bad if people are cohabiting. They may have kids. They may transition to a marriage. They only may be cohabiting with the person they ultimately marry. Well, what's happened in American society for virtually every group is that there's been an increase in the shares of these cohabiting unions that are not segueing to marriage. They're actually breaking up. So in the first case, you see, again, this is a paper that's online now at Demography by Koo and Kelly. Again, we've got data here from 1990 to 1995 and 2005 to 2010. And you can see for the college educated there, these are annual probabilities. You can see about 25% of cohabiting couples who are the most educated, that's on the far left-hand side this time, will transition to marriage. So it's in some ways it's kind of an intensive form of dating. That is, it's just the staging ground for marriage. But look what happens on the least educated groups here, especially on the far right, the less than high school, the high school educated. You can see that those groups are far, far less likely today than they were 20 years ago to transition to a marriage. And what they've transitioned to is a small share are continuing to cohabitate almost as a permanent alternative to marriage. But the greater shares have dissolved. And I've been doing a lot of work recently on serial cohabitation, moving from one relationship to another, and in some cases collecting children from different fathers from one relationship to another, contributing to this issue of multi-partner fertility. And it seems to be concentrated, again, among the least advantaged, the least educated, and those who are typically targeted by welfare reform. Let's talk about non-marital fertility. I know Bell Sawhill and I, a long time ago, we were talking about non-marital fertility. We really need to put the emphasis on non-marital fertility because it affects whether women marry, whether they stay married, and whether they marry an attractive, economically attractive man. Here's the upward tick. And again, this goes from 1940 on up to 2012. You see a slight flattening right after 1996, and then it goes up to 40% of all births in the United States today are non-marital, and we plateaued about 40%. What's interesting here, again, is if you look at 1995 and 2013, you can see, make the comparisons here. You can see the non-marital birth rate on the left, before and after, is the same. It hasn't changed at all. So when we talk about the rise in non-marital fertility, we're not talking about the rise in the fertility rate. We're talking about the rise in the non-marital fertility ratio. And the reason the non-marital fertility ratio is going up primarily is because we've seen this retreat from marriage. We have fewer married people who are contributing births, and we've seen some slight decline in marriage fertility rates among the married. But what's driving this 40% is the retreat from marriage. We've seen some success across all groups, especially among disadvantaged minority populations, the decline in birth rates among teenagers. This has been a major success. But again, what's interesting about this that I think we sometimes don't talk about is about 60% of all births today that are non-marital are to cohabiting couples, about 60%. We've seen a rise in so-called shotgun cohabitations, which I've done some work on as well. You know, we don't talk so much about shotgun marriages. The living arrangements of kids, I'm gonna finish up here real quick. Not much change again. Again, you look from about 1990 on to 2015, about the same shares of kids live in two-parent families, same shares live in mother-only families. What's really changed about the mother-only families is this big rise in the share of never marrieds. Again, the retreat from marriage seems to be a big part of this, and of course that share of rising with never marrieds includes the cohabiting parents as well. What's really changed here on children is the complexity of their arrangements, their family arrangements. And I can talk about all sorts of things. All these things have ticked up. Grandparents, same-sex couples, cohabiting couples where they're having kids, cohabiting couples where they're like step-cohabiting unions, remarriages, living with single father households, fosterage, adoption, joint custody arrangements. All these things make kids' living conditions much more complicated than the past. So the bottom line is really hard to show either with experimental data or with observational data, big data sets, or trends to show big effects of TANF. In fact, nothing seems to have changed at all except for maybe non-marital fertility among the young. And then it's hard to separate that from other things that are related to people not having kids. So instead, what I see is growing family complexity. I see much greater diversity in the pathways to family formation, that is marriage and cohabitation. And we see a really diverse family patterns across economic status in a period of growing inequality. The majority of babies in the United States today are minority babies, something other than non-Hispanic whites. We're seeing increasing differentiation on that. And we see big changes by geography, too. We've got an increase in the concentration of poverty, especially among children, immigrant families, among minorities, and so on. So question going forward, I don't have any time, do I? I think we need to spend some time talking about cohabitation and subsequent childbearing. I think we need to talk about America's transformation in the next 25 years to a majority-minority society, and the majority of children by the end of this decade will, the majority of all children will be minority. And we see that played out today in our racial politics. And we need to focus on geography, I think, for a lot of reasons, including the fact that we've turned this over to the states and to local areas. And here's my address if you need to get a hold of me or send me nasty notes. Thank you very much.
See, we needed that extra time. So I'm going to introduce our panelists here, and we're going to go in alphabetical order. So and they have
closer.
To also be seated in alphabetical order. Wade Horn is the director of the Deloitte Consulting Public Sector Practice and former assistant secretary for Melissa Kearney is a professor at the University of Maryland and a non-resident fellow at Brookings and formerly directed the Hamilton Project. And Belle Sawhill is a senior fellow in economic studies at Brookings, has had many, many roles at Brookings, and previously was associate director of OMB in the Clinton administration. And they're each going to have 5 minutes.
So I guess I get to go first. So for 6 years, I was the Assistant Secretary for the Administration on Children and Families in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But that was not the title I was known by. I was known affectionately by some and not so affectionately by others as the nation's marriage czar. Now, I must tell you that when you have a title, the marriage czar puts pressure on your own marriage to make sure that don't go wrong, and my wife had a lot of leverage during those 6 years. So as the marriage czar, what I endeavored to do is to determine if public policy could be used in some way to help couples who chose marriage for themselves to form and sustain healthy marriages. And in order to do that, I focused on three initiatives, and Daniel, you touched on some of them. There were three. Building Strong Families, which was focused on what researchers have called the magic moment when a child is born out of wedlock, the couple still romantically engaged with each other. Is there a way to help them with relationship education skills move towards healthy marriages? The other was called Supporting Healthy Marriages, which was an attempt to increase access for low-income couples to relationship education and marriage education skills building programs. And then community marriage policies. Now, which was basically do a whole bunch of stuff in a particular community and see if we can do something to help increase the rate of healthy marriages. But I also wanted to learn something. And so for the first two of those, we did national randomized controlled trials to determine what the effectiveness was of these programs. Now, in hindsight, I must confess, I wish I hadn't done that. Because if because I didn't know at the time that this apparently was our one and only shot at doing something about healthy marriages and public policy. And I didn't pay enough time, enough attention apparently at the time, to the late Peter Rossi's iron law of evaluation under metallic rules. The first being the iron law that the expected value of any net impact assessment of any large-scale social program is zero, and the stainless steel law that says the better designed and the impact assessment of social programs, the more likely the resulting estimate of net impact is likely to be zero. So I wouldn't have gone about implementing well-designed projects to evaluate healthy marriage initiatives if I thought this was our one and only shot. But I did. So what did we find? The Building Strong Families evaluation showed pretty much no impact. More distressingly, in one site but not in other sites, there was actually evidence of some increase in domestic violence, and which dissipated, fortunately, over time. But there was a very disturbing finding around that. Daniel, you mentioned that when it came to the community marriage policies, not only was there no impact, they couldn't find people in the community that even knew there was a community healthy marriage initiative going on in the community. And if you have no awareness of something, it's hard to have an impact. But supporting healthy marriages did seem to have a pattern of modest but sustaining positive impacts on relationship quality. So even at 30 months after the intervention ceased, compared with the control group, the program group reported higher levels of marital happiness, lower levels of marital distress and infidelity, greater warmth, support, and positive communication, less antagonistic and hostile behaviors in their interactions with their spouses, and less psychological abuse. So that's what we found. What did we learn? So I think what we learned is a few things. At least for the few marriage education curricula that we studied, that marriage education in and of itself is insufficient for this task. And that it seems that we need to add other kinds of services, not in substitute of, but in addition to, in my view, the marriage education services, and particularly employment services. Everything we know about the relationship between stable employment and access to employment and marriage would suggest that integrating that would be a good idea. So, is it time, based on the study of three specific models and a limited number of marriage education curricula, for us to give up on marriage as a focus of public policy? I would say that given what we know about the correlation between healthy marriages and child well-being, I would hope not.
Okay. Good, thanks. So I'm actually going to echo some of the main themes that we heard Wade talk about and even some that came up on the first panel. So before I do that, though, let me highlight two of the key facts that Dan laid out for us. One, this 1996 welfare reform legislation did explicitly take as goals a reduction in the incidence of non-marital childbearing and an increase in two-parent family formation. And that alone is quite astounding if we think back on that. And two, if we look at aggregate trends, there's really no denying that this monumental legislation did not change aggregate trends. And Dan showed us a lot of stats about the retreat from marriage, and I just want to focus our attention on the retreat from marriage among parents, less educated parents in particular. So I never cease to find it quite shocking that now 40% of children in this country are born outside of a two-parent married situation, 70% for African-American children, a majority of first births to women with less than a high school degree or under age 30 are outside of marriage. These trends are they continue, and the levels really should sort of, we should view them as quite imperative to address and talk about and think about. So in my mind, this raises two particular questions. One, were the efforts of the reformers who wrote these explicit family, non-marital childbearing goals into legislation, were those misguided goals? And two, based on what we know now, should we set aside these goals, jettison them, and move in a different direction? And I'm going to answer both with a caveated no. So the first thing I want to point out, Dan didn't have time to review this evidence, the evidence about the benefits of a two-parent married family structure for children is quite overwhelming. Okay, I will be the first to admit we have never had a social experiment, nor should we, where we randomly assign children to married parents or not. Okay, so we don't have that gold standard. But the evidence is really, I mean, there are dozens upon dozens, maybe hundreds of studies coming from all branches of social science documenting that children who are born to otherwise similar parents, if the parents are married, the children's benefit. They are much less likely to live in poverty. They're more likely to graduate high school. They're less likely to engage in crime. And they have better outcomes as adults. And that shouldn't make us uncomfortable or think, gosh, that's really old-fashioned or moralistic. We could just think about this as a resource story. In this country, the way non-marital childbearing or child raising plays out is not like two stable, committed, co-parenting people who simply have chosen not to get married. Okay, that's not what it looks like in this country. Children who are born to married parents and live with married parents have access to much higher levels of resources. Their income is higher, sure. Two parents working bring in more income than one. Okay, as economists, like, we're comfortable with that or saying that. But it's more than just income. The kids have much more access to parental time investment and supervision, and they also have the benefit of stability. And Dan referred to this, and Andy Cherlin's written a lot about this. Kids who are born outside of marriage, their lives are much less stable. They will have multiple men living in their house over the course of time. They will be more likely to move. And, you know, we have plenty of evidence from social psychology and sociologists that, you know, and this shouldn't surprise us, that is disadvantageous for children. So I do think there was a lot of social science evidence that makes these goals realistic. So what did we learn through our implementation of welfare reform that tried to address this? We learned that the programs and policies that we put in place were not sufficient, and it's really hard to change these outcomes, and we don't necessarily know how. But I'm going to agree with Wade that the fact that the evidence was disappointing does not mean we should jettison the goals. Now, I'm going to disagree with Wade. I find it very disheartening to take away from that, you know, a wish that we never did that. We cannot afford to not hold our... Okay, but it's an important point because you hear this all the time from practitioners or agencies. They don't want researchers coming in and shining a light because there's a good chance we're going to find they're not effective or at least not find evidence of that. We can't afford not to be looking because we can't afford to throw good money after bad. But given what's at stake here for the kids, I think we should continue to innovate, continue to learn more, continue to think about ways to not only promote marriage for the families that want to be married, right? Like, marriage is hard and it takes skills. And we're fine saying that we want to give disadvantaged kids soft skills to negotiate with their employers or do well in the labor market, but you need those skills to negotiate with a lifelong partner too. So I'm fine saying that we should do that. And for couples who don't want to get married, we could still promote healthy two-parent and family fatherhood involvement, not just sending child support checks, but actually keeping fathers involved in the lives. This came up on the first panel. I hope we get to talk about it more. So moving forward, I think for the sake of the kids and the strength of the evidence, we shouldn't give up on these types of initiatives.
Well, it's hard to go last because almost everything has been said, but I want to very much agree with both Wade and Melissa that this was a reasonable set of things, concerns, for the law to have worried about. And there's no question, as Melissa just said, that there's a ton of research showing that marriage, on average, is better for kids. And if you want to read Ron's and my latest summary of the evidence, it's in the most recent version of the Annals. So I think the question is, can policy ever make very much difference in this particular area? If you're a conservative, you think if you bring, if you reduce welfare benefits or other kinds of social assistance, then people will really need marriage more. Women won't be able to be as independent, and so welfare reform should have increased marriage by making it more salient in people's lives. If you're a liberal, you think just the opposite. You think the more benefits that we give people, especially employment, the more likely they will be to get married. So it's an assumption on both sides of the divide that policy can make a difference. I've caricatured it, obviously. I don't think policy is ever going to make very much difference in this arena. I think this is mainly about social norms. I think the charts that Dan showed us shows that those norms have just been steadily marching forward. And if you look at less advantaged communities, and particularly African American communities, and you just look at the data, you know that that norm has more or less disappeared. And I find when I talk to practitioners or people who care about these families, they say that's never going to work. So what should we do going forward? Because we do think that something's been lost by the retreat from marriage in terms of the well-being of kids. And many of you know what my favorite solution is, which is we have to start focusing on unplanned pregnancies. The way to reduce births outside of marriage is to reduce unplanned pregnancies. Why? Because amongst single women under 30, 73% of their pregnancies and 60% of their births are either unwanted or badly mistimed. That means they don't have time to finish their education, they don't have time to get established in the labor market, and most importantly, and this is where Dan's research has been so interesting, they're less able to form stable relationships. Once you have a baby, it's harder to get married to a new person. And also, a lot of these cohabiting relationships, as his data showed, aren't very stable. And one of the reasons they aren't very stable is because they are shotgun cohabitations. And the people are living together because they had a romantic relationship, and guess what? They had sex and they had a baby, but they weren't really committed to the idea of being together for the duration of 18 years or longer than that if you have multiple children. And so you get this chaos of multiple parent fertility and serial cohabitations that has already been alluded to. So what would happen if we reduced unplanned pregnancy? It would have a big impact, and we have research that shows it would not only impact the parents, it would impact the life trajectories of the kids. Now, why are we not doing more of this? We have evidence. We have evidence from Colorado, where they've made a big push on this front, and they've reduced Medicaid costs dramatically. They've reduced unplanned pregnancies amongst young unmarried women and teenagers dramatically. I could go on and on about the evidence. There are some political controversies here. If we have time, I'm happy to get into them. Some of them are from the conservative side, some from the liberal side. In Colorado, they've overcome the conservative opposition now. Conservatives should like this. It saves government money. It leads to smaller government. It reduces abortion dramatically, which most conservatives don't like. And it is about personal responsibility. It's about only having a child when you yourself feel you're ready to be a parent. You know, my colleague Richard Reeves likes to say, accidents happen, but a child shouldn't be one of them. Thank you.
That was great. We've heard a lot about the past here, and I have a bunch of questions that are about the future, and then maybe one question about the past if we run out of questions about the future. So I think it's a fair summary that the panelists agree that welfare reform did not make a big difference in trends in marriage, in out-of-wedlock childbearing. The decline in teen pregnancy that we saw started before 1996, as you saw on his charts, didn't make a big difference in cohabitation or child living arrangements, with Wade thinking maybe that, you know, there still could be ways policy could affect marriage. Going forward, work for promoting healthy co-parenting relationships for the kinds of families AFDC used to reach? And I'll just give that up to the panel.
That's a big question.
Yeah. So I'll start by saying, I mean, my answer to your question relates to something Bell pointed out, which is, you know, to think about what works, we really do have to figure out what is driving these trends. And that's harder to answer than you might think. If you asked me 4 years ago, I would say, the retreat to marriage among these less educated populations likely is being driven by the decline in economic opportunities for men. And I would have said, what we need to do is strengthen the economic position of men. And, having the benefit of doing some more reading and doing some more research and looking at more data over the past few years, you know, some of which is still work in progress, I think that is part of the story. There's some nice work showing that the increase in females' wage relative to men can account for a substantial, but, you know, still minority share of the decline in marriage. Some work I'm doing with a graduate student suggests that, you know, economic shocks to low-income men shows, you know, a decline or an increase, if it's a negative shock, to the incidence of births that are outside of marriage, but not the full story. So I think economics is part of it, but I think Bell is right that changing social norms are also a key part. And I think there's lessons to be learned here from the example of teen childbearing as well, because that too has been a dramatic decline. And, you know, my view on that, looking at the evidence, is we can't point to specific U.S. policies that led it. It reflects changing perspectives and desires on the part of teenagers themselves to stay in school, to not become young unmarried women, right? So that's both an economic story and like a social norm story. And so then we get to the question of, okay, so how do we increase the economic position of low-skilled men, and how do we affect social norms? And I think that's why we're all shifting in our seat, because those are really big, difficult questions.
So I think the honest answer is we don't know. And so there's two ways you can deal with the answer we don't know. One is to say, so let's not do anything. And the other is to say, let's experiment with some things if we all agree on the goal. So I think the difficulty here is that, in contrast to like goals about reducing poverty, is there anybody in the country that would say, no, the goal should not be to reduce poverty? You know, the goal is to get more people in poverty. I think here the difficulty is that there is some controversy around the goal. And that makes it harder for us to have this sort of latitude to experiment with things that might get us to the goal, since there's some controversy about the goal. I think the Supreme Court decision removed some of that controversy around gay marriage. I think that that's a good thing, that's been removed from part of the sort of context in which we talk about this. But we don't know. So let's experiment a little bit. Now, one of the things that some people have talked about is reducing the financial disincentives for getting married. Even President Obama, in his 2013 State of the Union address, said we should not make it financially disadvantaged to get married. Do we know if that would work? No, we don't. We have no idea whether removing financial disadvantage will actually change things. Unless you believe that there are a lot of low-income people that are running around, you know, calculating how much money they lose in the EITC when it comes to a decision about marriage or not, I don't think we know. But should we experiment with it? Absolutely, we should. But the honest answer is we don't know.
Well, I would say that this is, again, a matter of needing to shift the goal from getting people married to making sure they can be good parents to their children. Now, a lot of us, I bet, know women who are in their 30s, who are maybe professionals and have decided for one reason or another, maybe they haven't met the right guy or whatever, to have a baby, to choose to have a baby as a single parent. Do we really worry about them a lot? I don't think we worry about them hugely. In fact, we increasingly say that should be a choice for people. I mean, I totally agree that two parents is better than one, but I respect the women who decide to do that. But the point is they choose and decide to do that, and they have the resources to be a good parent. And so I really think if we could shift the norm from let's make sure we're a marriage-friendly society, I'm not against marriage, but you know that I just think it's the genie is out of the bottle, to let's be a society that values children enough so that we engage in more responsible parenthood, it would make a big difference. So I'm arguing for the opportunity side of this equation as well. As Melissa said, I think it makes some difference because you're never going to be really well resourced as a single parent if you are from the group that we're worrying about, the less educated, et cetera, here. But it's just not going to work, I think, to say marriage is the solution.
Dan, did you want to chime in?
I don't know that I have much more to add. I mean, I remember when the welfare reform bill was first debated, there was so much discussion about marriage as a panacea, but if you actually talk to social workers or people who dealt with low-income populations, they always said marriage isn't the solution. Marriage is the problem for low-income couples because it affects, you've got men who are maybe violent or men who are sabotaging women's work careers, who are abusive in one way or another. So I don't know about going forward, other than I agree with Bell 100% about the non-marriage. I mean, you look at the data from the National Center for Health Statistics on the shares of pregnancies in the United States that are unintended, that is, they're either unwanted, there's a numbers failure, or mistimed. We're talking still about 50%, and very high for non-marital, lower for married people, but in the middle there are the cohabiting couples. So I don't know why we're not moving on that front, but it seems like some of the work that Bell's done and I've done, you know, we sort of look at whether women with non-marital births are the difficulties of getting married, the difficulties of staying married. Some of the work that I've done show that women who got married after they got pregnant to another man, not the father of the baby, but there were only like 20 or 25% of those women who were still married in their early 40s to that man, or marrying an economically attractive partner. So a lot of this stuff, I think, starts with non-marital fertility and an unintended too, which is a kind of a shock.
Can I say a couple of words about some things we could do that are really simple and cheap? In Oregon, they have a new effort, which I would call a nudge. You know, we all know from behavioral science that nudges are a big thing in public policy now. What do I mean by a nudge that they're using in Oregon? They are putting into primary health care systems in the state the one key question that women don't get asked right now when they come in for just routine health care, which is, do you plan to have a baby in the next year? If the answer is yes, then you get counseling on prenatal care and all the things you should be doing for your own and your baby's health. If you say no, then you get the next question of, so what are you doing about the fact that you don't want a baby in the next year? And that leads to a whole new conversation and a whole new possibility of getting same-day services with the most effective forms of contraception that exist, which most women are not using now. Only about 10 to 12% of all women of childbearing age who are sexually active in this country are using the most effective forms of contraception excuse me, that can make a huge difference in reducing unplanned pregnancy.
So I feel a need.
Sorry, can you just tell us all what you mean by the most effective.
So the new thing in birth control is what are called long-acting reversible contraceptives, which include the IUD and the implant. And the thing about them is they change the default. If you have them, you are not going to get pregnant until you decide you want to have the device removed. That's very different than using pills and condoms, which is what most young people use, because they require a lot of self-discipline and they require that you think about it all the time, whether to take the pill, whether to get your prescription refilled, whether to use a condom in the heat of the moment, et cetera.
Sorry, Wade, I just wanted to get that.
I feel the need for 15 seconds to clarify a couple of things so there's no misunderstanding with the people here. I never thought marriage was a panacea. Not in favor of violent marriages. That's why we called it a healthy marriage initiative, not a unhealthy marriage initiative. I also want to be clear that I don't think marriage is the goal. It's a goal, and that there are children will find themselves in lots of family structures, and I don't think we have any throwaway kids. And so whatever family structure they didn't choose what family structure they come into, and we should support whatever family structure a child finds themselves in. So it's marriage is a goal, not the goal.
I agree.
I just want to build on that. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I want to just make sure, 15 seconds. I was a supporter of the Healthy Marriage Initiative, much to the consternation of some of my colleagues in sociology. So I thought it wasn't very much money. Let's play around. Let's see what we can find out. I was supportive. In some ways, I still am supportive. But the evidence itself isn't particularly compelling as far as I can tell. Go ahead.
Sure. I'm going to take 45 seconds. I think we all agree and everyone would agree that like marriage is a goal, not the goal. But I often hear the retort that, look, these women aren't marrying the men because they don't bring positive resources and they're non-marriageable, is one term, from the older literature on that. And I want to pause on that for a minute because 40% of kids are now born outside marriage. I refuse to accept that 40% of, fathers wouldn't bring positive resources to the kids. So certainly it is the case that there are some marriages that are bad. It is also the case that for, if you even look where this sort of marriage premium is greatest, it's not for teenagers or 19-year-olds because their male partners wouldn't bring so much. Where you see the biggest differences in outcomes for kids to single parents or married parents is for women in their 20s and women with high school degrees. Because those are the couples that aren't getting married, and those are the men that, have jobs and are potentially marriageable. But that's really where we're seeing the retreat from marriage, and so that concerns me.
Melissa sounds more like me than I do.
Yeah. So this is a great segue to my next question. So it was exciting to hear about this new RCT for getting non-custodial fathers involved. But what we do know from the big RCT, that the last big RCT, Parents Fair Share, is the only thing it was able to move is how much child support was paid. And so I wanted to get this panel's thoughts on what can we do to get the non-custodial dads more involved in the families and not just paying more child support. And I think an additional challenge with thinking about some of these experiments is that they're primarily voluntary programs, and there's a whole set of unengaged couples who are not signing up for voluntary, healthy marriage kind of things. And what can we do for those couples?
Ron? I phoned a friend.
I said among the things you can do is to get the fathers more engaged prior to the pregnancy, that you'll have better child outcomes in the first place. And I think the other thing that you can do as we think forward is if we're up to 60% of children who are born to women under 30 are born to unmarried parents and the parents are cohabiting, that has a huge implications for the diversity of who we understand non-resident fathers to be. They are no longer parked in low-income minority communities, but if all these kids are being born to cohabiting couples, those couples are going to break up. The fathers in those couples are in the high school education and below, and you're going to generate lots of men over the next 20 years who are unable to meet their child support obligations. So we are way out of where we were in 1996, focusing on low-income minority communities. This is a challenge that's a generic challenge for all the children we're going to think about in the next 20 years.
So I would say around the issue of how to get more couples interested in and engaged in things like marriage education, and there is a fair amount of evidence that marriage education has impact on relationships. But this is not just an issue for low-income couples. This is an issue across the income span when it comes to couples in general. And most couples believe in the soulmate theory of, you know, successful marriages, which is if I find my soulmate, then there'll be no problems, as opposed to the sort of working model of marriage, which is it's a lot of work. But it's hard to get people really excited about marriage by saying it's a lot of work. You know, when you're married. I think part of it is sort of changing the general culture, understanding about marriage, that marriage is really is a, yes, love is important and all of that, and that's terrific, but also it takes skills, and that skills are something we learn, we're not born with, and I think that's a message that should go out broadly, not just specifically low-income people.
You know, I don't usually make this argument, but I will today, which is building on the question and what Ron Minsey said. We have a ton of men, young men, in our society now. You know, put aside maybe the well-educated, the very well-educated, but he's right, it's everybody else. It's probably, you know, 60-70% of the population. They're dropping out of the labor market. They're not marrying. They play video games to a fare thee well. I mean, you know, I don't want to be too cute here, but I mean, they really are... they no longer have stable lives. They no longer are connected to families and to other civic organizations. And many of my colleagues, when they read my book, Generation Unbound, their biggest reaction was, oh my God, you're really ignoring, Bell, the importance of marriage for men's lives and the stability of their lives, you know, that marriage civilizes men. Now, you know, my usual comment on that has been, hey, we women don't want to have to civilize men. We want them to be civilized to begin with. But, but you know, there is something to that argument.
Okay, so I think we're about out of time for comments from our panel on my questions, so I'm going to turn to the audience. Can we start with Janet here?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on a little bit, actually, on what was just being said, in the sense that it sounds like you could think of the skills that people need for a successful marriage as being a subset of the type of soft skills that they need for everyday life.
Yep.
You know, so the same kind of negotiation skills you use with your spouse are the things you'd use with your employer, your fellow workers, for not getting into fights in the bar and all those kinds of things. So to what extent should we be thinking about promoting healthy relationships as an outcome of more general social skills or soft skills training?
Absolutely right. Think that we should, and I hope some of the later panels will talk about that. You know, there are some programs like Becoming a Man that have been well evaluated that I think are trying to do exactly that. There are socio-emotional learning programs now in elementary school that have some positive track records, I understand it. So, yes.
Just one additional comment on that. You know, one of the things that's easy to do is to point to the silly ways in which states used some of this money, for example, on relationship classes for the non-poor, right? And in a similar spirit to what we said before, because states didn't use this money effectively doesn't mean we should jettison the idea, right? And so, you know, one of the things we might experiment with are these soft skill programs, Becoming a Man, and then tracking outcomes like successful relationships as well.
Here in the front row.
This is the comment, Larry Mead from NYU. This is the comment I expect people expect me to make, but I can't avoid it here.
And that hey, remember, question. Otherwise, Ron's
the question is, why has nobody said anything about social authority, maintaining the value we say we have in marriage, and even, God forbid, enforcement? That is, should we simply say to people, marriage ought to be defended, and it's not a good idea to have a child out of wedlock or to not to get married at all if you're having children, that this simply is wrong. That was part of the way we defended marriage traditionally. Now, I know that had costs. I'm not saying it's a totally good solution, but it did prevent two-parent families. Why don't we talk about authority?
It's a great question in my mind, and you know, there's a piece of me that agrees with what you're comment in the form of a question. But there's a piece of me that also says it's a delicate balance, because I do believe there is legitimacy to the argument that if you go too far in one direction, you start to stigmatize people that live in other arrangements. And I'm not sure there's any evidence that would suggest by stigmatizing a type of family structure, children do better. And so I don't think we've found that balance in how we talk about this as a culture. And I don't think this is a government issue. I think it's a cultural issue. So how do we at the same time say two things that seem contradictory, which is that marriage is, you know, all the evidence is that marriage is the most effective on average family structure when it comes to enhancing child well-being, while at the same time saying to those children and those families that are something other than two-parent married households that they are valued, they have worth, and that we are there to support them as well. It's a very difficult thing to do, but I think it's something we need to strive to figure out how to do that.
I couldn't agree more with Wade that it is very tricky, and I would also point out that people like Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers have done research that shows that if you go too far in the other direction, like going back to fault divorce and that sort of thing, you get suicide, you get domestic violence. The suicide statistics from their research are really woke me up. I mean, the number of women committing suicide because they felt they couldn't get out of an unhappy marriage is something worth looking at.
Lady in the second row in the front here.
I am a teacher and a parent. I'm wondering what discussion went on about mass media. I mean, I think what is shown on, I mean, I'm just appalled. And Juno doesn't help, or no, what was it, Juno?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. I just am appalled and think that has to be part of the problem.
So I agree on the point about Juno. So for those who don't know that movie, it's a teenage girl gets pregnant, and it's a very happy ending. And what makes social scientists upset about that movie is that that's not the typical ending. So I'll give a shout out to the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. They work a lot with the media to give them scripts to have parents talk with their children about these issues, to have couples pull out contraception or talk about it, and so they recognize this. So I've done work that suggests that this might be surprising, but there's an MTV show that follows pregnant moms, and some people are like, this is terrible, it glamorizes teen childbearing. What we actually find is that this show presents a pretty realistic picture that it's really hard to be a teen mom. And in the places where more people were watching MTV, after this show came on the air, we saw relatively larger declines in teen childbearing. To the extent that MTV managed to reach teenagers, show them something on their level, say, look, it's hard. You're going to fight with your boyfriend. You know, episode after episode, the boyfriend's not there by the time of the birth. You're going to fight with your mother. You're going to get up all night. It's hard. And teens responded by avoiding getting pregnant. And so there's a role to play for the media. Yeah. So my point is, media can be a force to promote social things we don't like and social things we like. It's a very powerful force. And so, getting the content can affect outcomes. I see your point is you don't like the content and you think it's driving bad things. My point is we could potentially leverage it for good.
Okay, one more last question.
Sorry, hello again. I'd like to ask about sometimes the friction between what's taught in high schools and social services from cities or counties. And specifically, I live in a very affluent county around here, and the high school was declining to have a program to teach unwed fathers skills of dealing with a baby because they said it's not part of our core educational function, and any money for that program should be provided by the county's sort of HHS funding. But it's this finger pointing at the high school level about core skills that are needed to negotiate life and whether or not you potentially empower young men who may or may be potential fathers.
Thoughts from the panel?
So I would prefer that we have curriculums in school that teach boys and young men how to be good boys and good young men, whether they're wed or unwed. I remember early on when I was doing fatherhood work with Ron Mincy and others, someone got up and said, let me tell you a great fatherhood program we have. And we have this big sign that says, are you an unwed father? Boy, do we have a program for you. And everybody applauded and thought that was a wonderful thing. And then I raised my hand as the skunk in the garden party, and I said, where's the sign that says, if you're not an unwed father, boy, do we have a program for you. And so we have to be careful about the messaging that we give, I think, to your point and to your point as well. And so I'd rather see those kind of skill-building programs be more broadly defined and be, in some ways, more preventative than always sort of after the fact.
And on that note, we're now in the break time. Thank you very much to the panel.